to know it was wrong to cheat the trying men. Don't you know it was wrong to cheat the trying men? Don't you know it was wrong to cheat the trying men? Don't you know it was wrong to cheat the trying men?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
It looks as though the angler, Dick Cheney, could be jailbait. You know, obviously there's a lot of people who feel that he's gotten away with too much and that George W. Bush got away with a lot. And there's been no punishment for essentially shaming the name of the United States, if you will, abroad. Clearly, there have been tremendous detriment to our foreign policy when dictators like Gaddafi and the current murderers in Syria and Mugabe in Zimbabwe can get away with murder and torture because they can always say, well, the United States does it, so what's your problem? I mean, there is a terrible stain, a permanent stain that's affecting our foreign policy. So where do we stand in terms of whether or not there will be some accountability? Because it looks like our president is quite determined that there is no accountability.
Some developments in the last 2 weeks are really noteworthy. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. You know, the predicate question is, will there ever be anyone at the highest levels held responsible for, you know, the illegal torture program, illegal wiretapping and eavesdropping and all of the lawlessness of the Bush years? And I think the resounding answer to that has been no. And I think that the Obama administration has made it clear not just that they wouldn't hold the prior administration's feet to the fire, but that they would in fact obstruct the legal system from moving forward. And so they not only defended people like Donald Rumsfeld or John Yoo or other architects of the torture program in court, but they invoke things like the state secrets doctrine, which is an attempt to get the whole lawsuit thrown out of court. So the Obama administration has not moved things forward at all. But there was a development in the recent weeks that is noteworthy, at least in terms of drawing attention to the issues. A federal court in Washington, D.C. decided last week, and then a federal appeals court based in Chicago from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal also decided this week that suits against Donald Rumsfeld, named personally for the torture program, could go forward. These suits could proceed to trial. This is a big deal because all of such suits, similar suits, have been thrown out prior to this. And so it really is, it's early days. The courts make no finding of fact. They're not making a judgment about what happened. But what they are doing, and what is dramatically different from what prior courts have done, is they're saying, you know what? There is enough merit to the claims in this suit that it can go forward and a jury can look at it or a judge can look at it and determine what happened. And that is, like I say, early days, but it is a big deal. And moreover, it's a big difference.
So let's talk about these two different suits, Dahlia Lithwick. The D.C. suit where Judge James Gwin ruled that citizens don't lose their constitutional rights simply because it's wartime. That involves a translator who claims to have been tortured by U.S. forces at Camp Cropper in Iraq. Now, is that person an American citizen?
He is, and he's a John Doe defendant. The court has granted him anonymity, so we don't know what his name is. That's different from, and I think I may have said the Fifth Circuit when I was speaking before. I meant the Seventh Circuit, which issued the judgment on Monday. That's different from the Seventh Circuit suit, where we know the names and the identities of the folks who were tortured. But yes, in all three suits, we're talking about American citizens working for the military toward the effort in Iraq. In the Washington, D.C. suit, he was a translator. The two who were working in the Chicago lawsuit were working as contractors, defense contractors in Iraq. So not only were they American citizens, arguably, they were trying to help the American side in the war effort.
Well, their story, Dahlia Lithwick, is just extraordinary. I mean, it really, here we are in Hollywood. I mean, this is a movie. You have these two fellows, a Navy veteran, Vance and Ertel, who are working for a defense contractor. And they became informants for the FBI because they saw all kinds of shady activity with illegal weapon sales, etc. And then their employers basically got wind of what they were up to. The military raided this company and hauled everybody off into custody. And suddenly these whistleblowers found themselves being treated as terrorists. And this brutal treatment went on for months and weeks in each case.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is a colossal screw-up. Because they were involved with this contractor Shield Group Security, when they were captured, initially rescued by the military, suddenly the allegation was, well, you're involved with them, therefore you must be part of their shenanigans. And both Donald Vance and Nathan Ertel kept saying, no, no, you don't understand. We're whistleblowers. We're involved with them because we couldn't know what we know if we weren't involved with them. One of the things that's problematic is that the military appears to have continued to hold Vance long after it became clear that they'd made a huge mistake. But yeah, the suit is based on the idea that their abuse, and it really looks to be horrific abuse, and the Seventh Circuit opinion goes into detail about how they were hooded, they were thrown into walls, allegedly they were treated to extreme cold temperatures, sleep deprivation, all the usual litany of the abuses we've seen with respect to enemy combatants, except of course they weren't enemy combatants, but they were treated to all those abuses. And the allegation here is that Donald Rumsfeld himself, acting in his capacity of defense secretary, authorized this maltreatment, and he personally should be on the hook in this civil suit.
Well, of course, I started the interview out by talking about Dick Cheney, which clearly we're talking about Donald Rumsfeld, but the reason I did is because they're joined at the hip. And I assume that if this case goes forward, that relationship between Rumsfeld and Cheney will come to the fore.
I think it's certainly the case that the hope is, and this is all the various lawsuits brought by the ACLU and other groups who are trying to find some accountability for those top officials in the Bush administration, that there is some hope that all of them get swept up in this and that they are all held to account. I want to be very careful to emphasize this is not a decision on the merits. This is the court saying two things. One, there is enough evidence that they have alleged sufficient facts that Rumsfeld personally can be liable. And two, he's not immune under this doctrine of immunity. But the court says that is assuming what the court has to assume for purposes of dismissing a suit, that everything that Vance and Ertel allege is the truth. So he's not saying it's the truth. He's saying, I won't throw it out if these things are true. So I think that it's fair to say, and there's one other thing that's so important, Ian. The other claims that Rumsfeld made in defense are very familiar to those of us who've been following these torture suits. One of them is, oh, it's not for the courts to interpose themselves into these military affairs, right? What do judges from far away know about what's happening in the battlefield? The judges made short work of that claim. And the other thing is this state secrets doctrine, which is what defendants in these torture suits continuously use and have very effectively used to get entire lawsuits alleging torture thrown out of court. The argument is, oh, the fact of our torture regime is such a secret that if it came out in court, it would harm national security. And even though that's a laughable proposition, we know everything we need to know about waterboarding, that has succeeded in claim after claim. So the court in this case said, nope, I don't accept that as a grounds for dismissing this suit. And so those are important chinks in what Rumsfeld and the Obama administration have been alleging to try to get the suits to go away. I don't know that this is going to be a successful suit down the line. I think where it's important is a national sense that these things are happening, that there may be consequences in court, that this occurred. It didn't just occur to someone in Iraq who was an enemy combatant waving a gun against American forces. This occurs to a Navy veteran who is in Iraq trying to help the country, doing the work of a whistleblower, and still he gets swept up in this. Those things were very, very important to the Court of Appeals, that this is Americans who should have civil remedies for torture when the American government tortures them. So I think that more than the efficacy of this suit, who knows where it's going to end up, is the drawing of attention to this principle that if we allow the government to torture people in secret at Guantanamo, it will bleed into how we treat Americans at home. And that is exactly what happened here.
Again, I'm speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the Supreme Court and judicial issues for Newsweek and Slate. So the judge in this case involving the Navy veterans Vance and Ertel, his statement here is, this court was faced with a choice between protecting the most fundamental rights of American citizens in the difficult context of war or leaving those rights solely in the hands of politicians and the military. Now, that certainly does seem to resonate. Do you feel, Dahlia, that, you know, we're living in a political environment where the majority, we just learned that 82% of the American people are absolutely disgusted with the decisions just made by the Congress, this debt ceiling deal, and they feel that the Congress should be focused on creating jobs, not austerity. But the truth of the matter is, the majority of the people's voice doesn't seem to matter politically. Does it matter in terms of the judiciary?
It's a great question. I feel like torture is one of those examples of how we have developed a new normal in this country, and that which was shocking when we learned about it in Abu Ghraib is not just normalized, but somehow we've almost put some value on it so that, oh, you know, 10 years ago, if we thought about waterboarding, it was horrifying. Remember, you know, Americans have been opposed to waterboarding forever. We've prosecuted people for waterboarding in this country. It was unthinkable. And suddenly you get a sort of jokey, right? Here's Dick Cheney describing it as a dunk in the water. John Yoo saying, oh, we only waterboarded 3 people. Maybe it was worth it. So I think that it's quite the contrary. And I think public opinion polls suggest that Americans have actually become quite comfortable with torture over 10 years. I hope I'm wrong about that. But it seems that public opinion has hardened to the point that we say, oh, well, in a ticking time bomb scenario, there's no such thing, by the way, but in one, certainly okay to torture, so maybe we should torture everybody all the time. And so I don't know that public opinion is hardened against torture. I do think that the courts have kept a real hands-off approach to all of these issues. I think that with the exception of a handful of Supreme Court decisions that laid out markers for how you can and can't treat detainees, the courts have really deferred, and this state secrets doctrine is a good example of that. When the government comes in and says, oh, well, we can't be on the hook for this in a court of law, the courts have tended to say, oh, you're right, we can't get into this, we have no expertise about this. So it seems to me what's changed, at least in the last couple of weeks, is courts saying, look, your claim in defending Donald Rumsfeld here is that even if everything that is alleged is true, everything that Vance and Ertel allege is true, the government still gets away with it. That's the defense here, and that's where Judge Hamilton balks here. That's where he says, I can't accept the proposition that fundamental constitutional rights of Americans are violated by Americans, and there's no recourse. So it seems obvious to us that that is a position judges should have been taking all along. What's dramatic is that judges have not taken that position. So as I say, it remains to be seen how this particular case and the case out of D.C. progresses. But I think it's important to see the judiciary finally say, I'm not going to be fobbed off with claims that we have no business interceding in this dispute. We have absolute business interceding when a constitutional right has been violated by Americans of Americans.
So, Dahlia Lithwick, how do you think the constitutional lawyer who now sits in the Oval Office would view this?
Well, as I said, I think one of the issues on which President Obama has been quite disappointing is accountability for the architects of some of the worst lawlessness in the Bush administration. I think, you know, he took a strong position against the state secrets doctrine, but has invoked it repeatedly once his Justice Department held the reins. He's taken a very strong position against torture for closing Guantanamo. On that, he was thwarted. On the closing of Guantanamo, he was thwarted. But certainly, I think as a constitutional lawyer, those of us who looked at him and said, here's somebody who understands deeply and fundamentally the violence that was done to the Constitution in the Bush era, he's going to fix it, I think that hasn't been the case. I think that he has this notion that we need to, his words, turn the page, move on, look forward, not backward, and not create some kind of witch hunt where we go after a handful of individuals for wartime decisions. And so I think it seems to me that that's been the position they've taken almost from the outset. And it seems to me that the problem with that analysis is that you can't move forward. You really can't move forward unless there's been some kind of reckoning with what happened before. And this president, admittedly very busy with other issues, with the economy, with the war, everything else, has just determined that moving forward on these issues is a pragmatic decision. It seems to me that the courts are not really in agreement with that posture.
But Dahlia Lithwick, the president clearly does have his hands full, but one of the reasons why he's losing ground and may lose the next election, particularly on the economy, is that he has not been able to reverse the economic illiteracy in this country, where the Republicans have been able to convince a majority of Americans that the deficit is the greatest problem, as opposed to economics 101 that tells you that during a recession, you have to prime the pump, not turn off the tap. And clearly Wall Street has repudiated what the Congress and the president have just signed off on, as we've noticed with the turmoil on the markets, that taking $2 trillion out of a sick economy is counterintuitive. So he's failed, I think, to make his own case. And I feel in many ways that we need not just a teachable moment on the economy, but also in terms of what you just said, which is that the majority of the American people do not understand how pernicious and damaging torture has been for the United States. And they've been sort of swept up in that Fox program 24, that notion of the ticking nuclear weapon, the car bomb, which of course is entirely in the realms of fiction.
I think that's not only right, but I think I would double down on that proposition and say not only have the Americans been swept up in the idea that whereas torture was once unthinkable, now we make efficacy arguments about torture, right? Now we're saying, well, if it works, maybe it's okay. Whether it works or not is immaterial. We don't do it because it's illegal. It violates international conventions. It violates domestic law. It's been off the table for centuries. So the idea that now we're debating efficacy is really horrifying to me. But I would go one further and say, what happened when we captured Osama bin Laden and killed him a few months back, and the conversation very quickly became torture defenders saying, you see, we got him because we waterboarded. Because we waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, we got a critical piece of information that led us years and years later to Osama bin Laden. Again, that's an efficacy argument. That's not an ethical argument. But more pointedly, and this is the thing I guess I really want your listeners to think about, the argument has changed from ticking time bomb, right? This is a guy who has critical information at this moment that could stop an imminent attack. Now we're being offered something called a mosaic theory, whereby something that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed didn't even say while being waterboarded, the allegation is it's something he didn't say while being waterboarded, was a critical piece of the puzzle, and that's enough to justify torture. So I just want to think about the slippage there. We've gone from torturing someone because they have all the information to stop an attack to torturing someone because someday something they don't say may or may not be a useful piece of a larger puzzle to get someone else. That's unbelievable. That is justification for torturing everyone you capture all of the time because they might say or not say something that may be useful in the future. That's where we are in the conversation about torture today.
Well, just a couple of minutes here at the end, if I may, to change the subject, because yesterday I spoke with the New Republic's John Judas, who has been covering the Romney campaign up in New Hampshire. And he made the remark that he thinks that this will be a one-term president, that that Obama will lose the next election. And, you know, that's obviously one person's speculation. But what would the impact be on the Supreme Court of a Republican presidency?
You know, it's so hard to know because we're really looking at 78-year-old Ruth Bader Ginsburg and saying, is she going to retire or is something going to happen to her? And that's ultimately between her and God Almighty. So it's very, very hard to know. I certainly think that we have a Supreme Court at this moment that is carefully balanced between four liberals, four conservatives, four extreme conservative, and one moderate but very conservative moderate Anthony Kennedy. I think it's going to be a game changer when Anthony Kennedy retires. That's when somebody has the opportunity to put in either a reliable liberal or a reliable conservative, and really, I think at that moment, tip the balance of the Supreme Court forever and for a long time. But I do think that it is the case that if Republican wins in 2012 and Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires, there is a strong possibility that that could happen early. But all eyes right now are on Anthony Kennedy, because I think if and when that retirement happens, that really is going to be thermonuclear confirmation process, where it's hard to imagine either side ever acceding to the other side's nominee. And I think we're going to see rock bottom ugliness in confirmation, which, as you know, is already a pretty despicable process. But I think it's going to get much worse when Anthony Kennedy, who really is the swing vote at the court, is in play. So really, I think in the near term, it's a question about Justice Ginsburg. She says she plans to stay on until Louis Brandeis's age when he retired, which is 83. But, you know, she has had two bouts of cancer. It's very, very hard to predict any of these things, and quite macabre to even engage in it. But I think that certainly there is a distinct possibility of losing that fourth liberal voice at the court if something were to happen to her and a Republican were to win in 2012.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Dahlia Lithwick.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dahlia Lithwick, who is a contributing editor at Newsweek and a senior editor at Slate, where she specializes in covering the Supreme Court and judicial issues. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about a new report, The State of America's Children, 2011.
You when your race is right.